Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have emails. Gabe, you have emails.
Yeah, I got one from Larissa. This is in response to the type 1 diabetes news that we talked about last week. Stem cells being used for the first time to make a pancreas work again with regard to the beta cells in the pancreas that cause diabetes or when it doesn't work. She says, Gabe, you took me on an emotional roller coaster this morning when I thought that stem cells might soon be successfully curing type 1 diabetes, but then the rest of the story emerged. I'm sorry to hear that you live with the disease. My sister was diagnosed at age 6 in 1983, and my daughter was diagnosed at age 4 in 2009. So I feel like I have lived with diabetes for most of my life, even though I am lucky enough to only carry the genes, but have never been exposed to a trigger that would have made my immune system attack my pancreas. Thank you so much for your program. Wishing you unicorn blood sugars.
Unicorn blood sugars.
100. So your pancreas keeps your blood sugar between 80 and 120.
Mm-hmm.
And the best value based on that is 100. And a unicorn blood sugar is when you've seen me take out my meter.
You pull out your smartphone and you touch it to your shoulder,
yeah,
which is reading your blood sugar.
Yep.
And then you've got like a, it goes up all the way into 300,
yeah,
sometimes, or yep, then all the way down to like 50, right?
Yeah, exactly. And when it's 100, that is the unicorn.
Interesting. Okay, that's perfect blood sugar.
That's the perfect blood sugar, 100, yeah.
When we talked about this last time, mm-hmm, you mentioned discovering the kind of the idea of a pancreatic transplant.
Yeah.
Did you look into that?
I have. It's on my back burner, as they say. I am going to at some point. It's based in a Dutch town, Leuven, I believe. I'm going to get in touch with them and see if I can get on that list.
Yeah, yeah. Keep us.
But thank you, Larissa, for writing. And I'm
thank
sorry
you.
That you have to deal with that. You know, just like you said you were sorry that I have to deal. I'm sorry that you have to deal with
yeah.
By proxy.
Let's get to the science. Gabe, you've got what for me here?
The American Cancer Society looked at cancer deaths and what percent of those could be avoided. So they were looking for modifiable factors or lifestyle choices leading to cancer. They looked at 262,000 cancer deaths. This was 2019. And from their analysis, 40% could have been avoided.
Wow, quarter million people. Yeah. Pass away from cancer, and two out of every five of them could have been alive.
I'll focus here on smoking. One out of three of those deaths that could have been avoided was because of cigarettes. And smoking cigarettes, I do it.
Yeah, full disclosure. Yeah. Full right? disclosure, Gabe. You don't do it here at DW.
Never.
You never. We've got balconies where a lot of our colleagues will go out and just suck down cigarette after cigarette.
I can't stand looking at it. I cannot stand watching them. What? Yet I go home and night falls, and then the pack opens up and.
Yeah. You've said that to me. It has to be dark outside for you to do that. Which is, I just find that interesting. Anyway, go on. So you're part of the. You're not blameless here. You're part of the group that's doing this.
Lung cancer risk. If for me, I'm a smoker, 23 times higher than for you. If you smoke, it's 23 times higher. That doesn't mean if you smoke, you're automatically going to get cancer, though. 15% of people who are full-time, like those people on the balcony smoking all day long, 15% of those people get lung cancer. So it's not like you automatically get it, but your risk for getting it goes way up. And I'll just remind you some of the carcinogens. There are 70 known substances when you burn tobacco that are carcinogenic. Acetone, acetic acid, ammonia, arsenic, rat poison, benzene, butane, hexamine, cadmium, carbon monoxide, formaldehyde. These are all known things. Right?
Well, and I think you put it right there, burning tobacco. We know that caffeine, when you drink it in coffee or tea, is relatively fine for us, right? We get a little jolt. It's not carcinogenic.
Yeah.
If you took pure caffeine, sprayed it on a maple leaf, rolled up the maple leaf, lit it on fire, and then inhaled the caffeine that way, that's not good for you, right? The act of smoking it is not good for you. Nicotine, you know, the jury's still out. Anyway, so the act of smoking is bad.
So the one study I was looking at this week was the American Cancer Society looking at what you can do that will cause cancer. Another study that came out is about vaping out of England. They were looking into just how many people vape. The numbers were off the charts. And just before I get into that.
And just to be clear, vaping
this is e-cigs, e-hookahs, yeah. mods, vape pens, vapes, tank systems, personal vaporizers, anything where you use a battery to heat up
a liquid.
Vaporize a liquid and then inhale that.
And there's nicotine in there.
There is
somewhere.
Nicotine in there, which, by the way, is not carcinogenic, which is weird. Anyways, the global prevalence of e-cigarette use for people who are currently using them is 11% around the globe. So 1 in 10 people right now is vaping. In England, what they wanted to find out was how many people, and this is between the ages of 16 and 24, who weren't smoking before. So mm-hmm. this is a longitudinal study. They got in touch with them when they were 16 and all the way to 24. The people who weren't smoking before, so who were non-smokers, who by the end of the 8 years were then vaping, okay. 1 in 7.
1 in 7
1 in
started.
7 of the people who weren't smoking at all to begin with are now vaping. So the idea that vaping is just, it's for people who are using it to quit smoking is hogwash.
Right.
Not at all the case. People are vaping who weren't smoking before. And then the question is, how unhealthy is vaping for you? Because even though the FDA has authorized it, it's not approving it, it's under regulation, there aren't many scientific studies looking into the toxicology of vaping. There are a few out there. And in e-cigarettes, there's nicotine, there's propylene glycol, there's acetaldehyde, formaldehyde, diacetyl, acrolein, benzene, heavy metals, nickel, tin, lead, cadmium.
All
of these things, because people haven't been vaping for long enough. It was a Chinese invention in the early 2000s, I think 2004, was the first time that e-cigarettes were available on the market. So we don't have as much robust research into what it does to human beings. There are very few toxicological analyses of vaping, but there is stuff in there that absolutely causes cancer. If you think about cancer being DNA damage and prevention of DNA repair, acetaldehyde, formaldehyde, those things are absolutely carcinogenic. So be careful.
At the very least, safe to say, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look promising. And I'm going to rely on anecdote here, namely, and this may resonate with our pulmonologist listeners out there, doctors looking at scans of lungs and without knowing who the patient is, having to estimate whose lungs are these and taking a look and, wow, these look terrible. These are the lungs of a 60, possibly 70-year-old lifetime smoker. And it turns out, no, these are the lungs of a 23-year-old who started vaping at age 12 and has been hitting that vape pen ever since.
Yeah,
and again, that's an anecdote. It may be one extreme outlier case,
yeah.
but the evidence is slowly accumulating that this is not good for you.
Yeah, I don't think any scientists would say that vaping is better for you than smoking. It's very probably, I guess, better, not as harmful as smoking a cigarette that's burning the tobacco, but still it's not necessarily good.
As a non-smoker, I sure appreciate the vapors. It smells a lot
better.
They
smell better.
Yeah. I'm kind of paraphrasing a meme that says, gall darn it, right when we were quitting smoking cigarettes, the industry went out and made it smell like cotton candy. and now you have all these people doing it who weren't doing it before. I, as a neutral third-party person standing waiting for a bus, I sure appreciate that smell. But yeah, for the person who's doing it, not good for you. We have something... It's kind of a lot, and so I'll try to keep this concise. It's connected to AI. We just went out to a supercomputer over in Jülich, Germany, the site of what will become Europe's fastest supercomputer, to talk there about the publicly financed large language models that are going to use those machines. This OpenGPTX, that's Germany's publicly financed model, Trust LLM, Europe's model. And so kind of thematically connected to that and to the news, the Nobel Prize news for physics this week, which went out to the AI pioneer researchers, two of them anyway. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a little more about that. And just to go to the prize first, this was for the basic research that led to AI neural networks, the pattern recognition, the idea that machines can learn from themselves.
These two guys came up with that single-handedly. These were the two who the fathers of machine learning, if you will.
John Hopfield from Princeton, Jeffrey Hinton from the University of Toronto. It's Jeffrey Hinton. He's called, referred to as the godfather. We'll kind of focus on him,
okay.
The godfather of AI.
Yeah.
That's a huge title.
Yeah.
I don't know how happy he'll be about that over the long term.
You come to me on the day that my daughter is to be married.
I know. Not that kind of godfather. He's not a mafioso. He is a physicist. I've watched a bunch of interviews with him. He's not sure what he is. He actually went into the field of biology, and then it was combined with physics, yeah. And then it became computer sciences. There was a critique online. Sabine Hossenfelder, she's a well-known German physicist and YouTuber. She said, odd, kind of, that the physics prize, the Nobel Prize for physics, went to non-physics. Mm. But then again, the neural networks that he and John Hopfield created, they're based on physics. It's how, just like the neurons in your brain, how nodes can connect with each other to save information and to establish patterns.
She's probably wondering, computer science math would have been more apt?
Possibly. Could have been for mathematics, but yeah. In this case, physics. In any case, what's really interesting, and that's more or less why I'm talking about it today, what's interesting about Jeffrey Hinton is he, in 2023, left Google, a subsidiary of Alphabet, because of the dangers of AI. Of this thing that he helped create, this thing that he just got the highest award ever for, the Nobel Prize for Physics. He helped create it, and he left Google because of what is happening with it, and he's scared of it. In fact, the things he wants to say in public, he couldn't say while he was with Google, because then he could damage the company's reputation. Now he's saying them out loud. We're going to get to his final argument in a minute,
yeah.
But we're going to start with one problem that was predicted previously, possibly also by Jeffrey Hinton, and that we're now seeing actually happen, like daily on the internet. This is connected to the idea of the dead internet theory. Gabe, I don't know if you've come across that.
No.
The dead internet theory is the idea that we are heading toward a future where the internet is full of AI-generated material, mm-hmm. and that bots, which many of which have already been pre-programmed today to go online and to post things,
okay.
are the ones generating the content and then replying to the content, and then other bots then generate more content, and you have an internet filled with AI-generated slop.
You're looking at all these conversations happening. You think there are human beings behind them, and it's just some robot.
That's phase one. Here's phase two, speaking of Google. This one went viral this week. Gabe, you're looking at a bunch of
pictures.
All I did, any of you listening right now can do this at home, go to Google Image Search and search for baby peacocks.
Baby peacocks.
You see anything weird there?
I'm seeing a bunch of pictures that could easily be baby peacocks.
Yeah. And I would say roughly 10 to 20% of those, if you look closely, Gabe, are fake.
Really?
Look closely. You'll see them. They look like animation. They look like something you might see in an animated movie. If you look at the bottom right, you'll see one held in the palm of a hand.
That one, okay. That looks like almost anime.
Right.
Yeah.
So now imagine you're a human being trying to figure out what a baby peacock looks like, and you're confused because what does it look like? Which one of those is real and which one is not? And how long until all of those images are unreal?
And that will be then the death of the internet.
That's the...
When there are no longer people behind any of this content, it's just generated by some ones and zeros.
That's the dead internet theory, that the internet as we knew it, full of content created by human beings, is slowly vanishing before our eyes. I like that example because you can actually see it.
Mm-hmm.
Images that are fake that cause people to think they're real, and where did the real images go? How would I know the difference? How can I test this? And now we're going to move to a similar concept, also connected to Google, and this is the dead internet theory as it comes to audio. This, what we're doing right here, Gabe.
How about the dead journalist theory?
Well, yeah, that would be more connected to the LLMs. But so this one, Google has a product that's had it for a while now called Notebook LM. Very, very, very useful for anyone out there. If you have a very complex PDF or a couple of PDFs, you upload it and you can ask this tool, Notebook LM, questions about the PDFs.
Yeah.
This is great for scientific studies.
So the source of the material, it's not the internet itself. It's a document that exists. You feed this LM a document, and based on that document, it creates what?
You take Notebook LM and you give it a PDF, a scientific study, like this one right here from Nature Communications.
Yeah.
The title is Florida Current Transport Observations Reveal 4 Decades of Steady State.
It would take us a day to go through that, maybe 2 days.
Yeah. Well, so
to summarize that,
what you can do is you take the digital version, upload it. It's all been scanned, and I just ask it questions about this. What is this study? What did they look at? Which tools did they use? How long was the study? And it answers it for me based not on connecting to the internet.
That's what I mean.
Based only on the data right here okay. in this paper. That's a highly useful tool for getting very specific answers based on what is actually inside
and
this
you said,
text.
And you said audio before. It answers you in audio form. What does it tell you?
This is the new innovation. And here's the point where all of our listeners are going to have to decide for themselves kind of what they think of it, because it's kind of scary. What they do now is, in addition to getting answers to any question that you ask, they create a fake podcast between it with an artificially intelligent generated voice of a man and a woman, and they discuss the paper in a way that is scarily close to an actual podcast. We'll go ahead and listen to about 1 minute of that podcast that I generated.
That text right there.
With this text about this study, okay. Here are two fake people talking about it.
Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're going with the flow, you know, diving into ocean currents. Mm. But not just any currents, we're talking about the Florida Current, that warm, powerful one that flows up Florida's East Coast.
Ah, the Florida Current. Yeah, it's way more important than most people realize, I think.
Right.
Like, this isn't just about some random current. It's a huge deal for the entire climate system because it's a big part of the AMC.
The AMOC, okay, for those of us who aren't marine biologists, remind us what that is again.
Oh, right. It's the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC for short. It's like the ocean's own personal conveyor belt, moving warm water from the tropics.
Okay, so it's moving that warm
water. Yeah.
I wish we were that good. I wish we were that good.
It sounds real. It sounds...
Oh, the AMC, dude, yeah.
It's not just, I mean, it's not just the intonation, it's the pauses,
The flavor words like.
Now remind me again. It's staggeringly good.
Boy.
It's scarily good.
Okay, and that document there is 20 pages of text. That is
so
dense text.
What Google has done.
How long did it take Notebook LM to create that podcast for you?
I downloaded this PDF from Nature Communications. I uploaded it and hit generate podcast. It was ready in 3 minutes. The podcast itself was probably 12 to 15 minutes long. That's how quickly you can generate this kind of content. It's good. It sounds very convincing. It's not always accurate. I don't know if any of you are probably very astute listeners heard the woman say, the fake woman say, the AMC current. She should have said AMOC the first time. That was wrong. Funnily enough,
I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, he corrected her, actually. This is the future, or one of the futures for audio. That's, I guess, what I'm trying to make clear to all our listeners out there. It's a useful tool. If you want an audio form, a 12 to 15 minute audio listen generated by AI of one study or multiple studies, keeping in mind that if something is wrong in the study, it's going to be wrong in the podcast. You don't have journalists behind it fact-checking, or you don't have other researchers.
You don't
researchers.
Have the internet. You don't have the internet behind it. It's just that document.
Right. And if the internet is behind it, how much better is that? It's just what I anticipate based on this technology is in the next couple of years, podcast platforms around the world being flooded with AI-generated podcasts like this one that sound informative and sound convincing, that have no fact-checkers behind them. Just like, Gabe, the picture you had just now of a baby peacock that looked real at first glance, it's not real. It's bad. It's not a real peacock.
You also don't have any human beings behind it. And whether or not it's 100% right or not, is that what you want?
Right.
Is that what—I guess we could ask our listeners, is that what you guys would want?
Do you want that kind of podcast or audio or radio show? Are you okay with listening to that? Is it better than, I mean, we humans are certainly fallible, but when you put a lot of us together fact checking, we do a pretty darn good job of it at this point. Yeah, I will end this segment with just a final quote. This is going back to the winner of the Nobel Prize, Hinton, and him kind of summarizing how he feels and what can be done about AI. He's really talking about AGI, when artificial intelligence becomes even smarter than us humans and outstrips us, what happens then? This is his take on that.
So I think it's rather different from climate change. With climate change, everybody knows what needs to be done. We need to stop burning carbon. It's just a question of the political will to do that and large companies making big profits not being willing to do that. But it's clear what you need to do. Here we're dealing with something where we have much less idea of what's going to happen and what to do about it. And so I wish I had a sort of simple recipe that if you do this, everything's going to be okay, but I don't. In particular, with respect to the existential threat of these things getting out of control and taking over, I think we're at a kind of bifurcation point in history where in the next few years, we need to figure out if there's a way to deal with that threat. So I think it's very important right now for people to be working on the issue of how would we keep control. We need to put a lot of research effort into it. I think one thing governments can do is force the big companies to spend a lot more of their resources on safety research. So that, for example, companies like OpenAI can't just put safety research on the back burner.
I mean, last week, didn't we hear from Stefan Kesselheim from the Jülich Research Center here in Germany? Publicly funded research?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way?
That was his argument. That is what the winner of the Nobel Prize, the godfather of AI, was saying when he got called, actually, by the Nobel Committee. That was his phone call with him. And at first he was saying, I was happy to hear your Swedish accents. That's how I knew it was you. That's his argument. We need this technology is moving so fast. Almost no one can keep up with it, and especially governments cannot. And that's his. If you're feeling helpless, sitting there listening to this right now, listening to a fake podcast that Connor generated in 3 minutes, and looking at fake pictures of baby peacocks, things can be done. You just need to support any government official who is regulating this, because right now it sure feels like a lot of it is unregulated. I think that's the message from the godfather of AI.
Yeah. What do you guys have to say about any of these topics today? Let us know at su@dw.com. I'm fallible.
You are. Okay. I am too.
There's a human being behind this podcast right now.
And we're going to finish up here with one final email from one of our longtime listeners, Brent. Brent sent us a link to a study. The study is from the Oregon Health and Science University. It's about pathways in the brain and how they've been seen for the first time with a really powerful MRI with all these implications for how the brain clears toxic waste. Mm. And how, you know, if that's not working properly, it could be, if not a causal factor, but connected to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia. Brent, it was a great email anyway.
Yeah, we now, thanks to the study, we now know exactly those pathways. And Brent, whether you know this or not, you sent us that link before this study went viral. The science community is now talking about this. So you sent it 36 hours before that. And we got in touch with Aaron Yamamoto, involved with this study, to get a sense of what it is, but also how important this could become for a lot of people out in the world dealing with neurodegenerative disorders.
Science Unscripted.
So I'm Aaron Yamamoto. I'm a sixth-year neurosurgery resident at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. And together with some of our other neurosurgery faculty and my mentor, Dr. Juan Piantino, we published a recent paper looking at the system that we believe is responsible for ridding of waste in the brain for the first time definitively in humans.
What is that system, Aaron, that rids my brain of waste?
Yeah, so it's called the glymphatic system, or at least that's what it's been dubbed, about 10 years ago by a team from the University of Rochester. This process was dependent on a network of perivascular spaces, and that is the route in which spinal fluid moves from outside the brain tissue inside the brain tissue in order to flush out those waste products. And that's really what we were honing in on.
This is a wild idea, but would this kind of be like if aliens were looking at a human city they would be pretty sure that right water's going in, and then sewage or gray water is coming out, but they didn't know where and how that happened exactly. And now, for the first time, these aliens have figured out, no, this is how it works. This is how the sewage, I guess the sewage in this case, flushes back out. Is that kind of?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Like, they see that maybe, okay, clean water is coming this way, ugly brown water is going that way, but now they can see that it's actually going through a pipe.
And now that we know this route, or where this fluid goes in and goes out, and where the waste comes out, will this help researchers then? Does it help? What does it do for our knowledge of the diseases that arise because of the waste in the brain, like dementia?
This particular finding, I think what will contribute to the field is increasing that awareness, because even though the glymphatic system had been, you know, shown in mice, people are starting to understand this system probably exists in humans, even though we didn't have this small piece of the puzzle. And there certainly are many studies now looking at just at that, you know, looking at how much beta amyloid and tau, you know, two proteins very commonly associated with Alzheimer's disease, how much of that substance is found in the spinal fluid of those patients, as it pertains to the ebbs and flows of waste removal in the glymphatic system.
Now that we know that the glymphatic system is essential to waste removal, I guess my question is, how do I make my glymphatic system work better? Are there lifestyle? Is there anything I can do to make my glymphatic system as great as possible?
Go hit the gym to work on your glymphatic system.
You know, yeah, that's a great question. I think the field is in such infancy, we don't really know. The one thing that has been shown that I think is well accepted is that sleep is important. You know, they're showing that within this whole system of waste removal, the process of spinal fluid and the brain tissue fluid exchanging, you know, that's a critical piece of the waste removal process. And that exchanging of fluid is promoted by deep sleep.
And that was Aaron Yamamoto talking to us from the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland in the United States. And just a reminder, or maybe not a reminder, new information for some people globally, dementia, according to the WHO, affects 55 million people. That's why we talk about it, when there are developments in the field of neurodegenerative research and potential treatments. It's why we talk about it. It's a lot of people.
Yeah. I believe it's in your family, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my own personal bias for kind of paying attention to it. Both my grandmas, it's there. It's a possible fate for me, myself. And so, yeah, I'm always interested in who's working on what and how effective. Because you're talking about that with diabetes, but every year there's a breakthrough and now it's finally going to be treated and then it doesn't quite happen. When are we going to be done with this in the future? Mm-hmm. Hopefully sometime soon, and hopefully connected to the work we just talked about.
Yeah, thanks to Aaron. Thanks to Brent for getting us interested in this particular study.
And how about the rest of you?
How about you guys? Sleep well. Sleep well.
Oh, so you're trying to help them. I'm trying to extract more from our listeners. Brent sent us a great study. How about everyone else sends us great studies as well? It changes the show. It really does. It just did. SU@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.